Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink, inspiring public curiosity about food. Learn more at MOFAD.org.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, Heritage Radio Network's weekly food news roundup. This week, we're celebrating Black culture through the complicated lens of agriculture. We speak to Carla Hall about her uncompromising soul food recipes.
And I was like, what am I doing? Why am I changing my family's history for another culture?
We also hear from Gabriela Rodriguez at Harlem Grown's Youth Farm Uptown.
About empowerment and, you know, community resilience building through this work. Food is kind of just a vehicle.
Leah Penniman addresses feeling like an outsider in the farming community.
I could count on my two hands the number of people who appeared to be POC, people of color. And so I literally would go around little slips of paper and say, hey, meet at 1 o'clock under this tree so we can talk.
Tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network. That's Meat plus sign THREE, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Christine Collado. We'll talk to Christine about wine, retail, parcel, and a lot more. We'll taste a Bourguignon Blanc Chardonnay from Rouy for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Christine Collado got a quick start in fine wine and dining, at places like Dinex Group's Bar Balloud, Balloud Sud, and Flagship Danielle, moving to wine director at Brooklyn Fair and its three-star Michelin tasting menu. She recently left to help open Parcel Wine Store, a curated wine shop near Hudson Yards in New York City. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Christine.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you here. All right, so you have an interesting background. Let's let people in on it. So give us a little more background on your journey in life and wine that got you to sort of your current gig today, which is working in retail at Parcel.
Sure.
And I don't want to start in kindergarten.
No, I hear you. Okay. I guess I have to say that I like to tell people that I almost made a hit list. Very early in my career, I made a list of people in the industry that I wanted to work for. And I used that as a guide as to how I could achieve, in what I wanted. So I started as a server, and I was learning about wine, and I was excited. And
so back up a second. That yeah. was in hospitality, restaurant.
For
that
sure.
was the era. Okay.
Yeah. Early 20s. And then I quickly kind of fell in love with wine, and I knew that there was something there. I had been working at various restaurants in kind of downtown Manhattan, and I guess the first person that I really wanted to work for was Paul Greco. It was a big lover of terroir in the East Village, and I loved the community there, and I always felt good when I was in that space. And when he opened Terroir in Tribeca, I applied right away. I felt like that was a great place to start in working in an atmosphere that was casual and fun, but also serious and educational. And I loved the narrative that he kind of pitched early on.
He's a narrative guy.
Yeah, and he's wonderful. And he was a a big help in my confidence and my ability to speak about wine table size, simultaneously, you know, doing the things that I felt really comfortable doing, like serving and running food and all of the kind of 101s of being in a restaurant.
What year was that at Terroir?
Oh, geez, it was 10 years, almost okay. 11 years ago now okay. at this point. And then after Terroir, I knew that I wanted to kind of step up my game a little bit.
Terroir is kind of casual.
It was very casual. And Daniel Janis was a regular there at the time. And I remember him kind of asking me what I wanted to do next. And
You befriended him when he came in and hung with him?
Yeah.
I think his office was
it's
a little
just
further
around the corner.
East,
yeah. It's not too far away.
Yeah.
And he called me in for an interview and... he said, I think you should meet Michael Madrigal. And of course, at the time, I was a big fan of the Panier program, and I knew what Mike was doing. And I met with them a few times. And the first time, they didn't have a spot for me. The second time, it just didn't work out. And the third time, I was kind of like, all right, guys, what's up? And Mike and I hit it off. And again, he was a guy that I had my eye on, and I loved his narrative. I loved the execution. I loved the hunger that he had for wine and the community that was going there, you know, upper West Side, people were coming for
across from Lincoln Center.
Exactly. And we were, you know, there was people texting us at crazy times before lineup asking for us to kind of save them a glass of wine because it was something that was irreplaceable, large
you
format.
You don't see that everywhere.
No, you don't see
he
it ever.
He created kind of a
he created that
vibe in a community.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And he really treated us, like friends. And it was an amazing moment in being able to psalm with him on the floor.
And that was Barbalud
and Blued
Suit.
Yeah.
Then what happened?
And then Daniel Janis was kind of asking me again what I'd wanted. And so he thought that Restaurant Daniel was the next step for me. And that was an intimidating time. I mean, that restaurant, at that time, it had 3 Michelin stars. I had no fine dining experience at all. And they were taking a big chance on me.
But you wanted to fill that blank in? Like, let me get some fine
dining. For sure.
So you definitely were anxious to
Absolutely.
Try it.
Yeah. And Raj was... working for Raj was amazing. I mean, every single night you were opening
Raj
up.
Raj Vadia,
yeah.
Who's the wine director there.
Absolutely. You were opening up something that was significant and one of those benchmark producers in those vintages. That was a real, real education and something that I'll cherish forever.
Right, that's a special place.
Yeah.
But the fancy schmancy doesn't end there, right?
No, it doesn't. Raj, you know, we became very close friends, and you know, after a few beers, he said, "You know, what's your next step? Like, what's going on with you?" And I said, "I'm looking to kind of create my own list or be a part of something else." And Michelle Smith was leaving Chef's Table at Brooklyn Fair to move to France, and they needed someone to take her position. Raj, being friends with both of us, said, "I think you guys should meet, and maybe Christine might be a good replacement." Which is something that he didn't have to do, but I think he really saw that I had the skill set and I had the ability to work and perform at that level. So I met with Cesar, and I think we quickly hit it off, and that restaurant in Brooklyn is truly special.
So we're talking about Brooklyn Fair, which is another 3-star Michelin restaurant, a tasting counter.
Yeah, 18 seats.
18. There's a few more now, not Brooklyn Fairs, but tasting counters.
For sure.
Then there were not a lot. I've eaten there, and Cesar seemed like an intense dude, was he?
He is. He is, as he should be.
But good and nice. Yeah. I mean, he was good to you?
Cesar was great to me.
So just people can imagine a Danielle or a Jean-Georges or, other big legacy per se. Brooklyn Fair, a little different. Like you said, it was a tasting counter with how many seats?
18.
You sit around, I think, a U or a horseshoe.
Yep.
You face Cesar in the kitchen. And how many courses are we talking about?
It varies, but anywhere from like 7 to 9. You know?
Right.
Yeah.
A lot of fish and all of that.
Yeah.
So you're there And we'll talk about that in a few minutes. You're there how long?
I was there for, the project was I was to be coming on board and helping facilitate the move from Brooklyn to Manhattan. And that took some time, even after I had joined the team. It took us.
Were you on the floor in Brooklyn?
Oh, yeah.
You were?
I was. I felt that it
and
was.
And the move happened while you were there?
Yep.
Brooklyn Fair moved from Brooklyn.
Brooklyn.
To 37th Street?
37th and between right. kind of 9th and 10th, yeah.
Right. So how long were you at the New York location?
It was in total for Brooklyn Fair. I was there for about 2 years.
Okay.
So I spent about a good 8 or so months in Brooklyn, and then we moved to the restaurant to Manhattan.
All right, so you spend some time there, and not that long ago, you leave there. So answer two things. Why'd you leave, and where'd you go?
I left personally because I guess I checked all those boxes, right? I went back to that drawing board, and I saw all of the people that I'd worked with, and I knew that I had to move on. And I guess that's just how I am. You know, when I accomplish something, when I feel good about what I've accomplished, I look to something new and something else. And I knew that working the floor at that level was something that I couldn't do for much more time. You know, it's intense. Just it's hard.
The grueling intensity of it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
is much of a high an adrenaline rush it gets to you, right?
It's a show every night. It's being on Broadway, you know?
Right.
It's all the time. It's high performance. It's there's no sick days. There's no bad days.
Long hours.
There's long hours.
So you pack that in.
I did.
And you become a horse trainer or what?
I don't know what I thought I would become, but I knew I needed to take a break. So I left and I took a few months off. I traveled. I ate a lot. I slept a lot. And then Grant and Robert gave me a call and they asked me to kind of have a coffee at Charlie Bird. And
Grant Reynolds and Robert Bohr are principals at the Delicious Hospitality Group. Charlie Bird, Pasquale Jones, you said.
Legacy Records.
They opened Legacy Records.
Yeah.
And along with Legacy Records came
Parcel Wine,
which is where you're working now.
Yeah.
We'll get to that in a minute. I'm just curious about a few things in your past. What was tougher, working the floor of a grand restaurant like a Danielle or really overseeing a counter of limited people, you know, with a very specific menu? I know they're two different experiences, but what was your take on that?
I think Chef's Table was, I'd hate to say harder, but it required a different attention to detail.
That's what I'm curious about. What do you mean?
The intensity was there. I mean, you know, as a sommelier, I think we sometimes kind of just think about that position as just being about wine, but that position wasn't just about wine. It was managing a team. It was the execution of dishes and precision and all of, you know, that team was so small and focused on all of the aspects of one's experience there. It wasn't just about wine.
And everybody handled everything.
Absolutely.
Clearing plates, glasses,
yeah.
Bringing the wine out, pouring.
It was a true orchestration by Cesar.
Is it also because it was smaller? You know, people are on top of everyone or not?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, everyone's conversation is mingled. Everyone's aware of who's
right.
drinking what. I mean, there aren't any hiccups. There's no room for error in
right.
that room.
Unlike a restaurant, you're a table away from somebody. Here you could potentially be sitting next to a stranger and sharing the same experience.
Absolutely.
And inevitably, you're going to talk to people. As far as the wine programs, now we're talking about 6 Michelin stars combined. I mean, a lot of people, kudos to you, don't, you know, get the chance to work through that.
Thanks so much.
What was harder? Was it harder to develop wine lists and pair wines at a Brooklyn Fair or at a Danielle? Now, I'll do a little setup. Danielle had the budget and a huge grand cellar and had been collecting. Brooklyn Fair, you know, 3 stars, people have expectations, but not as big. What was harder or the challenges?
I think the difference first and foremost was, you know, Danielle, there was a set menu, a set pairing, and Raj really kind of set the tone. At Brooklyn Fair, when I took over the program, I really had the ability to do whatever I wanted. And so I got rid of those set pairings because I felt every person who dines there should really feel a different experience for wine, at least. You know, everyone was getting the same dishes and the same menu, but I wanted people to be the drivers of that vehicle a little bit. And for their
So explain that a little more. When you talk about pairings, you offered wine pairings, probably by the glass, not...
I did.
And it was pretty much set. And it's like, why is this set? This should be...
I wanted to have a conversation. You know, I wanted to learn, what were you into? How much money did you want to spend? And how can I tailor this experience for you?
For by the glass and by the bottle?
By the bottle. It's whatever you wanted. I mean,
right.
Listen, I'm not... When I go out to a dinner like that, I want to drink a great bottle of wine, maybe two, depending on how many people I'm accompanied by. And I would work something out. You could start off with a glass of Krug. You could have a half bottle of white Burgundy. You can move on to, you know, a bottle of something from the Northern Rhone with some age on it. And that felt more authentic in my execution versus than just being robotic and offering them the same wine, the same food for every person.
I agree.
Yeah.
And that's probably what made it special. Is it harder if you owned each restaurant and you were starting up? What's harder, curating a terrific small list or having the luxury and budget of a large list?
What's harder? It's harder. It's a small list.
Because you got to get everything right.
Everything's got to be right, and everything has to serve a purpose. I think, you know, not that, you know, I look at the wine list like Danielle, the Modern, and those are beautiful libraries of wine, and they're to be cherished, but not all restaurants have the budget, and nor should. I think a small list that's concentrated, that has a focus, that has a purpose, is much more exciting and much harder. To create.
And the attention towards the type of food is important to what's on the list,
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, my guess from my experience was Brooklyn Fair seemed very seafood-centric.
Yeah.
Was that fair?
Absolutely.
So whites and wines that
mostly
go with,
champagne, whites,
right.
High acid, things that had nerve and energy to accompany kind of the freshness of the flavors that he works with.
Right. I'm curious, do you think there's a movement away from fancy and fine dining? I mean, not that those places are on the ropes.
Yeah,
they're terrific places. But, and we talked about this a little earlier, it plays into my millennial discussion. I mean, are millennials coming onto the scene where they're having an influence on who's eating at a Danielle or a Brooklyn Fair or a Legacy or Pasquale Jones? What's your feeling on that?
A little bit, and I think there's room for both. I think the younger generation feels more comfortable in a place that's a touch more casual and not as pretentious in just sheer aesthetics and formality. But I think they're also aware of quality in the product. I think there's room, especially in a city like New York, for both.
But the quality and product at Brooklyn Fair and Danielle are, you know, second to none.
Yeah. But I mean, I have to say that I think that if you're having dinner at Charlie Bird, the quality and product is there too.
Fair.
And pizza at Pasquale Jones. And not just because I work for those guys, but because I truly believe that and always have. Those are the restaurants that, that have a true place in our time.
And work towards making it a place. I think it's fair to say that probably if you look at restaurants that opened in the last 5-10 years, move more towards the Charlie Bird, Pasquale Jones model you know, the Danielle's and all that. The grand restaurants, there's just not a lot.
No.
I'm sure the expense and the market, too.
I mean, it takes a lot of people to pull something like that off.
Yeah. A guy like Danielle with a vision or a Caesar, you know, guys like that.
Yeah.
We may have broached this a little, but talk about it a little more. I mean, your reason for leaving the floor at probably, you know, among the best restaurants, was, did it, want some change? What else?
Anything else? I know, besides just the sheer, the time that I spent doing what I did, a personal choice and want was, you know, and what I hope to be one day is a mother, right? And so I, yeah, so it hasn't happened yet, but, you know, I knew that the hours and personally speaking, and this is, and I hope this changes big time because I would be so excited and so happy to support more women that are mothers on the floor. But it's hard, and just the logistics of that, I couldn't figure that out. And so, yeah, that was a part of the decision.
That was a big part.
Yeah.
The idea of maybe eventually becoming pregnant,
for sure.
Working partially pregnant, working as a mom.
Yeah. I mean, you're talking
much tougher.
You're talking like 12 hours on your feet and performing at that level and high intensity and picking up a case of wine and, you know, it takes a toll on your body, and that's just like the sheer reality of it. And for me speaking, it wasn't something that I saw doing much longer.
So for you, it was an obvious decision. You know, you're at the point in your life where you're thinking about that, and, you know, you have options to do what you want to do. Is the industry recognizing that? Are they sensitive to women? I mean, we talked about women in wine, and New York probably does a good job with women in key positions. But at some point, you know, maybe they do get married and want to have kids. Is the biz ready for that?
I sure hope so. I think there's going to be a lot of women in the next few years that are going to be faced with those types of decisions, really talented, smart, articulate women who are hard workers, who deserve a spot on the floor. And I hope that the industry recognizes and accommodates that need.
Is it to the point? I mean, do you know of restaurants having leave programs and things like that?
I mean, Danielle was great about that, okay. And early on. So I'm an advocate for those bigger corporations that have that structure,
right,
for women who are looking for their place, because I think those, you know, those companies are more suitable,
right,
to host that type of.
We hope that everybody, you know, is sensitive
so
to that
too.
At any level. There's really no excuse for large, medium, or small.
Not
everybody,
at all.
You know, should be aware of.
Agreed.
That.
Yeah.
You'll have to email me when you have a kid.
I'll let you know.
We're not worried about that now.
I think I'm good.
All right, I want to talk to you about retail wine.
Oh, yeah.
We talked about the restaurant biz. We talked about, you know, what it's like being there. I want to talk to you about retail wine, and I want to talk to you about Parcel, you know, specifically a little later on. Help me with this, because I think people are intimidated by wine.
Yeah.
We know they get intimidated by sommeliers.
Yeah, big time.
They get intimidated by wine lists.
Mm-hmm.
Some people handle it well. Some people take the wrong direction, not on purpose, just because they don't want to look stupid in front of their friends or whatever.
Yeah.
I think people may have the same anxiety when they walk into a wine shop.
Absolutely.
You know, it's like, what do I do here and all of that?
Yep.
So let's talk about, you are a wine expert, now you have your hand in retail. Give me some advice. Let's assume somebody can identify a good local store, you know, not the crappy commodity store.
Sure, yeah.
They walk in, and they kind of know what they like, but they don't know what they want. They walk in, what should they do? What would ensure that they walk out of there with good stuff? And stuff they like.
Honestly.
Which the question is, what do you do? How do you handle
it? What do
that?
I do? First off, I mean, as you were, and I think this comes from my experience on the floor is, you know, the first thing that you do when someone sits down at your table is you help them with a glass of water, right? You kind of get them comfortable.
Connection.
And you make a connection. That's not a transaction. That's not a, what can I help you with? It's just like, it's a welcome. It's a, hey, it's creating an environment that feels good. And so I have to say that we did a really great job of creating an environment, a shop that's beautiful and that feels good. And so when people walk into the shop, I offer them a glass of wine.
You really? Know?
Yeah. There's,
so that's not a norm throughout the industry. So that's personal to you in the store, yeah. And that's an icebreaker.
Yeah, it's an icebreaker.
So now you got that. Now
something's open, you know, you want to splash, and then I start a conversation. I give them some space, and I give them some time. I'm not a fan of being attacked when I personally go shopping, and I know that everyone's kind of their distance, and I think what's helped me is that, you know, I have intuition, and I kind of know if they're interested or if they're not, if they're just browsing, and I'll ask, you know, what brings you to the building?
So there's a sizing up stage.
For sure. Any professional will say that, right. You know, that's what they do. And I'll ask them why they're in the neighborhood or in the shop, and I'll explain a little bit about the selection and how the shop was kind of curated and designed, and as they're sipping
we'll,
wine.
We'll get to that, but yeah. Do you have a list of questions or things you
no.
go through that, I don't mean formal,
yeah.
but to educate you to what that guy wants. I mean, are you going to ask him?
Sure. I'll say, like, what are you into? Or, you know. I like red wine. Great. You know.
It's not enough.
From where? Or, you know, is there any producer in particular that you're into or a region that you're excited about? And I kind of, it's very individual. It's very spontaneous. I don't have like a set spiel or, and I think that's what people like.
Right.
The
pressure's not there.
Yeah. I give a lot of, you know, our guests the space. I let them kind of come to me, and, I think right off the bat, just they know that it's a curated selection. And so,
tell them a little about the store. But if I'm the consumer, are there a few things that I should be clear about or articulate? Like, I don't want to spend more than $20.
Absolutely.
Or I don't like buttery Chardonnays. Or
for sure. I mean,
you got to push the customer to have some prep. They can't be, I don't know.
Exactly.
Right? So you pull that out of
them. You pull them out. I mean, is there a price point that you're looking, you know, to spend within, you know, again, red or white, sparkling, what's the occasion? Are you cooking tonight? What are you cooking? Things like
right.
that.
Right. Food is an important part.
Food's a huge part of retail.
Most people are shopping for a meal or, you know, for a party.
They're
or
on
whatever.
Their way, you know, home from work, and they want to grab a bottle of wine, and they're cooking or they're ordering in, and
so you'll go through all of that with them, and at some point you're satisfied what you think they want, what they're telling you, that you can
You add all those elements,
okay.
And you start from there.
Okay. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to talk specifically about Parcel. We talked about people walking in and what they should know and, you know, how you're going to handle them. But when you walk into a store like Parcel, which is unique, you know what's available and how to get to it. So we're talking to Christine Collado. Christine is at Parcel Wine in New York City. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I got a bunch more questions. We're going to subject Christine to our wine list. And we're going to taste some Rouilly from France. You're listening to The Grape Nation. I'm Sam Ben Ruby. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. Featuring a variety of interactive displays, MOFAD encourages eaters of all ages to be curious about food. The museum currently operates MOFAD Lab, a 5,000-square-foot experimental space in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where Chow, making the Chinese-American restaurant, is currently on show until the end of March 2019. This exhibition celebrates the birth and evolution of Chinese-American restaurants, tracing their nearly 170-year history, and sparking conversations about food culture, immigration, and what it means to be American. It highlights the evolution timeline of Chinese-American restaurant menus, dating back to 1910, and also highlights a tasting section where participants get to enjoy tastings created by the country's most talented chefs who specialize in Chinese-American cuisine. Make sure you check out Chow while you still can. The exhibition closes at the end of March 2019. Check out MOFAD's tastings and extensive event calendar at mofad.org/events.
All right, we're back with my guest, Christine Collado. Christine worked her way through some of the greatest restaurants in New York and now is at Parcel Wine, which is in the Hudson Yards section of New York City, a very hot area. All right, Christine, let's talk a little specifically about Parcel, the wine store. We talked about retail and, you know, if you're a consumer, if you go in, what you should do. How would you describe Parcel, and is there a mission? What's your mission to accomplish?
I think our mission across the board was, you know, to have a conversation to make wine accessible. I think a lot of people...
What does that mean, accessible?
Accessible in the way that you talk about wine, in the way that you present it, the platforms in which you choose to showcase your wine. I knew that, you know, what made people comfortable even in the settings that I had worked in the past was the way that I could talk to them about wine. You could, it's not about dumbing it down, but it's about simplifying it and making that guest feel empowered and feel good about the choices that they've made.
Right.
I always used to say that, you know, I'm not the driver, I'm the navigation. And so you're in the driver's seat and you're making the choices and you're spending the money that you choose to spend, but I'm here just to navigate you. And you can take that or not.
Right.
And I think that that really helped in the way in which I approach the guests that come into Parcel.
So we mentioned this earlier. Parcel is part of the Delicious Hospitality Group, which is Legacy Records, which the store is right next to. Legacy Records,
yep.
Restaurant.
It's just, it shares in the same building, Henry Hall.
Charlie Bird and Pasquale Jones. Does what the restaurants do and how they approach wine affect how you run the store or stock it?
Absolutely. I mean, I definitely have a pulse and an awareness of what's going on in each one of those, you know, programs. And, you know, a nice option for someone who is dining at those restaurants is that they know that I can perhaps source that same wine for them if they're interested.
So a lot of the restaurant wines are available at the store.
Yeah, there's several.
Okay.
The whole, you know, collection is not just Charlie Bird or Legacy or...
Right.
But yeah.
But not every wine store is associated with restaurants, so there's some kind of circle.
Absolutely,
with all
as there should be. It makes sense.
Is there any approach... Here comes the natural wine question. Is there any approach to sustainable, organic...
Absolutely.
Low intervention wines. Is that part of it? Is that a big part of it? Is
it's
that
not everything. I think that we're, you know, I don't judge a wine because it's a natural wine, and I don't put it on the shelf because I think it's commercial and I think it's trendy to have a natural wine on the shelf.
Right.
I think that's just such an added bonus, and I'm fortunate to have, you know, all of those growers on their shelves, I think, work in sustainable ways. And but I don't necessarily have to, you know, be the proponent of natural wine. You know, I wouldn't say that Parcel's a natural wine shop, you know.
Right. But do you feel, because of what's out there and what people want, there's a decent amount on the shelves?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, that's what's happening today,
yeah,
a little, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, I would think people would want to walk into a Legacy and know those kind of selections exist.
So all of the growers
that we... it's definitely on the scene, but it's not... Like, I had Jorge Riera on. He put a natural wine program together.
Yep.
Labeled that. There were natural wine stores. That's not it, but there's a lot of selections available. Would you say there is a regional skew there? If I said what percentage of wines are from one region, would that region represent more than the others?
I think naturally it's heavy on French and Italian. And then, but there's a lot of movement and a lot of wines from Spain that I'm putting on the shelf, and from, you know, the New World, Northern California in particular, that, you know, we're all really excited about.
So let's talk about what excites you a little.
Yeah.
Talking about wine.
I hear you.
So you mentioned Northern California. There's a French skew and Italian skew. Is the French and Italian skew a little connected to the restaurant, you know, because they're French and Italian?
Yeah, but I think that's by nature, too.
Okay.
I mean, I've only worked with programs that really have heavily focused on French or Italian.
Right.
And I think with Grant as well, I think there's a true devotion to the wines of Italy and France.
So let's talk about some producers that are, you know, at the store. Before you answer that, answer this. I mean, the store pays attention to seasonality, right?
Yes.
I mean, if it's winter, you'll probably see hardier wines. If it's summer, you may see the rosés.
Absolutely.
And some cool whites. So that's important. So that affects what's on the shelves. But I'm looking for producers, regions, interesting stuff.
Yeah, I mean,
what are you loving?
What I'm loving? I mean, champagne is always, I think,
okay.
is a big thing. It's always been a focal point in what
you got a maker or two you like?
Oh, I love the wines of Etienne Calzac. I'm a huge
C-A-L-Z-A-C?
S-A-C.
S-A-C.
Calzac.
Okay.
Yeah. He's fantastic. You know, I'm a big lover of the wines of Georges Laval in Champagne and Coumières.
Okay. Give me some non-champagne.
Non-champagne.
Italian, French.
For
Loire,
sure.
Barolo,
I think for Italian, being, you know, even Ieri wine, Salvo Foti from Etna.
Okay.
What else? Valentini.
Etna's Sicily?
Yeah, Sicily.
Okay, so you're excited about Sicilian wines?
I think they're really exciting.
Great value.
Amazing value. There's a freshness. There's
good food
such
wines.
That mineral, great food wines.
Okay. Give me something from France.
Something from France. I mean, can I shout out the wine that we're drinking
now?
Yeah,
and then we'll talk about it more.
Yeah.
So just tell it without getting into it. Tell us what it is and why.
Chardonnay from Burgundy, from a village called Ruy.
R-U-L-L-Y.
Correct.
And it's a way to drink white Burgundy at a level that's not too expensive.
Yeah, it's a gateway into understanding just that Burgundy is still, there's parts of Burgundy that are still accessible.
This is the Côte Mâconnais.
This is the Chalonnais.
Chalonnais. Okay. Yeah. And we're going to taste this in a few minutes, but that's the perfect example of getting into a region at a good price with good quality. And this is the type of wine that's on the shelves.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
This is the type of wine that I think gets you into kind of having that as your everyday wine and then doing a little bit of research and that being a gateway to producers like Dominique Lafon, like Jean-Marc Rouleau, like all the big boys. But we have to start somewhere, right?
Right.
And I think this is a great place to start.
And by the way, if you don't graduate to those guys, you're in good shape drinking
exactly.
this stuff.
Exactly. No, I'm happy with this.
What? So it's a curated list. You walk in and there's about how many selections? This is important because it's a specific type of wine store.
Yeah.
You're very selective in how much wine and what wine.
At the moment, it's about 150 on the shelf.
Okay. 150 different wines?
Yeah.
Okay. What would you say price range, the sweet spot is?
The sweet spot? I mean, I have something on the shelf as inexpensive as $20.
So 20?
On the high end on the shelf, I would say high hundreds, you know, 130, 150.
But that's a minority of the wines. If you push that guy out, you're looking at a lot of selections, what,
50?
20 to 50?
Yeah.
And killer curated wines and all of that, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
And what about... I mean, these are wines that are ready to drink now, right? I mean, the idea
that was that was the whole plan.
Explain what you mean by a wine that's in drinking condition.
Well, drinking condition can mean a lot of things to a lot of different people, right?
Right.
But I think in terms of when you're purchasing wine for consumption the day of, or perhaps in a few days' time, you want something that's showing well and has that life and freshness that's apparent in the wine. And I think that it's not just about current release wines, but having a real understanding of a vintage and where it is at its time, and then deciding on if it's, you know, appropriate to have that on the shelf.
So if there's a wine, you know, well known, and it comes out and it's just not ready to drink, either traditionally it needs, you know, years in the bottle, that's not necessarily a wine that makes sense to put on the shelf right away.
Yeah, but we still have the wine. It's in our cellars.
Right.
I mean, what's on the shelf is just a small snapshot of what...
Right, that's two different things. In the cellar waiting to go on, and something that's ready to drink, which
absolutely
plays into the point.
And we have clients and we have guests that that acquire those wines upon release and cellar them as they should.
So we talked about this earlier. What's harder at a restaurant, a smaller wine list or a larger wine list? Is that the same thing for a wine store?
For sure.
You got to like hit the right spots because you only have a few spots.
You know, I walk around the shop often and I look at what's on the shelf and I'll say, okay, we have a wine from Burgundy that's 35 and we have another that's 75. Where's that wine that's 60? Where's that wine that's $80? Where's that wine that's, you know, the next stepping stone? Or and I make a real conscious effort to take a look at what's on the shelf and what's being displayed. And is that grower the best grower from Barbaresco, you know, that we have for that price and for that everyday consumer?
So part of managing the frustration of a smaller list is always reviewing everything.
I
mean, do you get frustrated that you can't have, you know?
No, I love it.
Like, I need more SKUs.
No, it fine-tunes. It fine-tunes your palate. It fine-tunes your decisions. And you have to really believe in it if you put it on the shelf. It's not just an excuse or a filler. It's something that, you know, we took a lot of time in thinking about and feel really proud about. No, it's great.
So that's why if you're serious about wine, you're interested in wine, you really want to get the right stuff in your hands,
you're only going to drink the best there. You know,
you have to go to stores. And the good news is Parcel is as good as anybody doing it, but there are a bunch of other stores. You know, kudos to the small curated wine guy.
For sure.
In that sense. I mean, you have a great story with Delicious Hospitality, contiguous to the restaurant, your background and all that. But there are a lot of passionate guys in Brooklyn and New Jersey and Westchester and all of that. So we need to support those guys. All right, Christine, we're going to subject you to our wine list. It's five questions. We ask the same five questions. You should be nervous because I'm coming at you hard.
All right.
Okay?
I'm ready.
And you can't get up and walk out.
I won't.
Because I'll get Will to hold you down.
I hear you.
We ask the same questions to everybody. Don't dwell on them.
All right.
Let's move along.
Let's do it.
The first question is, what is Christine drinking now?
What am I drinking?
For personal, for the store, seasonal.
Samples. Sample wine.
But what? So you push all that aside and you go, this is good. I'm bringing this home. What's on the table?
I don't know. Muscadet. I'm
okay.
I love like briny, crunchy, raw white wine that's dry and
give
fresh.
Give me a maker or two that you love.
I mean, Pipier is like, you know, classic, right?
Classic.
Like,
give me one more.
I'm trying to think of what I have on the shelf right now.
Anything? You got something besides Muscadet?
Yeah. I mean, I would have to say that, you know, champagne again.
Okay.
Something that's like crushable and easy drinking. Beresh, of course, like his Brut Reserve
Is Beresh a good value champagne?
Oh my God, the best.
Berece.
Correct.
So Raphael, if you're looking for a delicious champagne at a reasonable price, Beresh. Okay, so those are good ones.
Hands down.
All right. So we asked Christine Collado, what is your favorite wine and food pairing? Kind of a silly question, the goofiest one on the list. Your pairing was an important part of your career.
Oh, yeah.
What resonates with you? Not that you eat it every night, but
no.
And you know we have a Grape Nation rule.
What is that?
No champagne and oysters.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay? All anything right. but.
Anything but. Well, can I stick with champagne?
100%.
Champagne, turbo, cream sauce, and mushrooms.
Turbo the fish, turbo. T-U-R-B-O-T.
Correct.
Why turbo?
I love when turbo is...
it's a firm white...
When it's prepared, you know, correctly, it's one of the most, you know, unctuous and textural fishes.
What kind of sauce?
White, like cream.
Okay. And that's great with champagne.
With chanterelles.
Cuts through the sauce.
Oh, yeah.
Because a lot of times pairing is sometimes more about the sauce.
It's all about the sauce.
Right, because you could screw it up if you just pair it with the fish.
For sure.
All right, that is a Grape Nation first, champagne and turbo. Good usage of champagne.
Well, thank you.
Doing well so far. You get around and about. You're Brooklyn-born, Brooklyn native.
Yeah.
Give me some favorite wine restaurants and or bars. Well, guys that are doing it well, selection, knowledge, fun.
Well, let's keep it in Brooklyn, right?
Let's go.
Frank's. I love...
John Patterson.
Oh, my God.
He just switched to a wine
he's
bar.
He's a freaking sweetheart. The wine list is impressive. And every time I go there, you know, I try not to look at other people's wine lists. I don't know if that's kind of crazy to say, but... I kind of just go with what I like and my palate, but every time I go there, I feel happy that him and I kind of align, and I see a lot of the selections that I have on the shelf with what he has on the list.
I got your back on that one.
Cool.
You got one more?
Yeah. I actually think that Four Horsemen, I recently had dinner
there.
Another
Brooklyn Williamsburg?
And shit. Wow.
That's a natural wine.
Yeah, it is. You know what? But they're doing it right. And
Justin.
And I was really impressed by my meal there and the service, the wine list.
I agree with you.
Really,
the food
really
is terrific.
Really happy about
that. All right,
that.
Let's keep it in Brooklyn. All right, so those are two good choices. As I always say, we're going to post your answers on our social media
and what we're drinking
and all that. Do you have a favorite all-time wine? Sometimes it's more than one.
This is tough.
I always say this. Sometimes it's not the rarest, most expensive. It's the experience.
Yeah.
What comes to mind under any of those?
I have to say that, you know, I was truly spoiled in my time in working where
I would
I've
think
worked.
At yeah. Brooklyn Fair and
so
Dynex.
It is probably a luxurious wine.
Let's
just
go.
Because, wow.
Let's go, you snob.
I'm not a snob. Come on.
Come on.
61 La Chapelle.
Jesus.
I know.
61 La Chapelle, that is what, Hermitage?
Yeah.
And that is a Rhone, all Syrah?
All Syrah.
Now, was 61 like one of these drop-dead vintages?
Absolutely.
61 Bordeaux was great.
It's a rarity.
Right? Okay.
I mean, that wine.
And just ethereal?
Oh, it was everything that...
And where did you drink that?
I drank that at Danielle.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a good one, and yeah. Old Hermitage is not a first, but that particular vintage in that wine.
I knew drinking it that it was probably the first and last time that I would have it.
All right, last question. And God damn it, if you're not the perfect person to answer this question.
Oh, boy.
Because you got to understand, I have winemakers in here,
yeah.
Sommeliers, journalists.
Oh, gosh.
Here's the question.
Pressure's on.
Best wine around $15.
Oh, shit.
$15 to $20 retail. I need a red and I need a white. And here's the setup.
Okay.
My son William here.
All right.
He's in his mid-20s.
Got it.
He's going to a party. He's trying to impress some friends. You can't send this guy out with a $9 bottle of wine. And he can't afford $40.
All right.
So he's 15, 18, 20, 21.
Got it.
Give me a red. Give me a white. You can give me a region like Muscadet. You can give me the maker. You can give me a grape.
I would say Riesling for
Wait,
sure.
Wait, hold on. Don't screw this up.
What's up?
Go ahead. No, don't screw the answer.
I won't.
All right, Riesling for white.
Riesling for white, I would say, you know, the wines of Keller, Uli Stein, these are true vignerons. These are real wines and that hold such amazing...
In that price range.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
Okay, so Keller and Uli Stein, Riesling categorically,
hands
those
down.
Are the makers.
Yep.
Great food wines, party wines, delicious. Go with the red.
The red wines. I would have to say.
Don't go soft on me.
No, I'm not. In that price point, God, Beaujolais is not even that price anymore, right?
Isn't well, that, is maybe. There any village stuff at 20, 22 bucks?
Yeah, I think some. I mean, actually, Michelle Smith's Beaujolais, her Beaujolais
the
Blush.
Village.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's just right around 25, 30 bucks on the shelf. But
all right, so we'll accept that because that's good. But
right.
Now we got to back into the price range.
All right.
You got to put your noggin to work here.
My noggin's work. Jesus.
What's a good red 20 bucks?
20 bucks. Oh, I know. Jean-Louis Chave, his Moncour, the Côte d'Aron.
All right, so Chave, great winemaker.
Yeah.
Moncour is what?
It's a blend of Grenache and Syrah.
M-O-N-C-U-R?
C-O-E-U-R.
Okay. And it is a blend of what?
Grenache and Syrah.
Great grapes.
Yeah, it's a Côte d'Aron.
And you're figuring around 20?
Yeah, it's 20 bucks.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, hands down, you're talking about a legendary winemaker, and if you're talking, you know, an accessible gateway.
I agree.
Yeah.
All right, so A plus.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Like I said, we'll post all of those. Christine, we're going to have to rush out of here, so we got a lot of stuff to do before we leave. Every week, we taste a different wine on air. I asked Christine if she'd be kind enough to bring in a bottle that is interesting, accessible, reasonable for us to taste on the air. So she brought in a 2017 Paulette Marie Jacquesson Grand Vin de Bourguignon Rouy from the Côte Chalonnaise region in Burgundy. Just give me a minute history on this wine.
I mean, this is, at this point, this is run by brother and sister team. Rouy is an appellation, the Côte Chalonnaise, which I think is really exciting. You have some really...
Côte Chalonnaise is part of Burgundy.
Yes.
So we're in the Burgundy, white Burgundy region.
For sure. An appellation that's definitely more well-known for its whites versus its reds, but they produce both. And this grower, I actually was introduced to it about a year ago at this time. And I was excited because I loved the price point. I thought the wine was classic and what you would expect from a white Burgundy, you know.
It checks all the boxes.
For sure. It's mineral. It has that broadness, but tension on palate. And I think that it's a great opportunity to kind of get into Burgundy and taste something that has real...
So Burgundy is so expensive, inaccessible.
Doesn't have to be.
Mysterious. This is a great white Burgundy. At a price in Burgundy with a region that makes terrific wines.
For sure.
All right, let's evaluate this. So we're going to give it a sniff and throw it over the tongue. Let's go color first.
Okay.
So it's kind of a light golden yellow, right?
Yep.
Not too deep, not too intense.
No.
All right, Christine, get that schnoz in there and tell me what you're getting on the nose.
I mean, it's those classic nuances of like apple and kind of that toast and a little bit of that oak that's showing on the nose. Just
so this is aged in some oak?
It sees about 20%.
Okay, so there's a teeny bit of oak.
Yeah, just a bit.
And is that a traditional or a classic?
I would say so.
White Burgundy nose?
So and what I liked about this wine, and not to get too technical, was that it wasn't overly reductive, and that's been a huge trend in Burgundy now.
Right, this is not reductive.
And it's not, and I made that conscious choice in buying the wine and also bringing it here because I wanted to kind of just talk about a little bit more of a classic way in which Burgundy was introduced to me.
So give me descriptors on the nose. Did you do that already? I forgot.
How much wine did you have?
Well, we drank champagne before you came.
Yeah, we're good. I would have to say, I mean, I smell like that mineral kind of
salty. So there's a minerality?
Salty,
salinity?
But almost kind of a deeper, richer kind of apple-like nuance. So I think this is very classic Chardonnay on its nose.
All right, let's go mouthfeel.
What I enjoy most, and we're having this...
Pretty full, right?
It's fuller. There's presence
medium
on the palate.
Medium plus.
For sure. But there's also structure in the wine. It's not loose or
Tell
blousy.
Tell people when you say structure, what does that mean?
That means there's a beginning, there's a middle, and there's an end.
It's not simple. It has...
It has length. It has...
Right.
You know, it makes you think a little bit. I mean, this wine, I think, provokes a more cerebral approach to drinking wine.
Agree. All right, let's throw it over the tongue and tell me what you get on the palate. Give me some descriptors. I suck at this, so that's why I brought you.
I don't believe that.
Do the palate descriptors match some or a lot of the
all of it?
Nose. So there's apple on the palate, minerality.
That crunch, else? That tension.
What does crunch mean? Raj Parr's favorite word.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Everything's crunchy that he loves. But tell people what you mean by crunchy.
It's the essence of soil, of place. It's that chalk. It's that mineral composition.
All those things can taste.
That give the wine texture.
Okay. Anything else? Any other fruits or anything?
It's all about kind of that orchard, apple, pear.
More orchardy fruits.
Yeah.
Pears, apples. Great. That's a great description. All right. Last thing on this wine. Give me the pairings. That makes sense.
Roast chicken.
With chicken?
I have this, I think about this wine. I think about roast chicken. I think about...
Where else can you go with this?
I can do fish. You can do...
Grilled fish.
Grilled fish, for sure.
You go with... like salmon-y, fattier fishes?
I would go with a white fish.
Okay.
Halibut or things of that nature that kind of can take to various styles of cooking.
White, sort of flaky, but some texture fish.
And like I also think something with a fish with a grill on it, that smoke, will accentuate a little bit of some of the flavors here.
Do we like this wine or do we love this wine?
I wouldn't bring anything that I like. I love everything.
And give me approximate retail.
This is $35 on the shelf right now.
Okay. So pretty damn good wine for the price.
Absolutely.
And a good entry point into Burgundy.
Yeah.
So that's the 2017 PM Jacquesson Grand Vin de Bourguignon Rouy from the Côte Chalonnais region in Burgundy. Thank you for bringing that in.
Thank you so much. That answers
the question of, what kind of Burgundies can I drink for a reasonable price? And that checks that box.
Yeah.
All right, Christine, we're going to wrap up the show. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Follow us on Facebook @thegrapenation. Follow us on Instagram @sbenruby. And follow the hashtag thegrapenation. On Twitter, we're @benruby and the hashtag thegrapenation. Also, subscribe to these podcasts on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. Like I said earlier, we'll post all of Christine's wine recommendations, selections. I'll post her wine list. I'll post the wine that we drank and some of the other wines that she mentioned on our media sites. Christine, if we want to follow you and we want to find out more about Parcel, where should we go on social media?
Sure. I'm at Christine Collado.
Spell it out.
CHRISTINECOLLADO.
Okay.
And then Parcel Wine on our Instagram.
All right. That's PARCELLE. All right. One last thing. My friend Daniel Johns is doing La Paulet.
Oh, yeah.
That is the end of next week. Go to lapaulet.com for more information. For people that are looking to get into Burgundy and fancy schmancy events like that, he has a terrific under 40 package. So go to lapaulet.com for more information. I want to thank our guest, Christine Collado.
Thank you.
For coming in. Thanks to our engineer, Matt. And... everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Van Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaili, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.